Let me just make sure I turn my mic. Yeah, it's turned on. All right, so let me begin, but, you know, in the same framework as yesterday where I began with, like, saying something about that had nothing to do with anything I'm talking about, let me just say something that has nothing to do with what I'm talking about, because I mentioned yesterday about this infinite continued fraction, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, and I said prove that it's the golden ratio. But there's something else. I think when I said something about continued fractions, I thought I heard somebody say the word Kinchin. You said Kinchin. So let me tell you something else that, to my mind, is like science fiction. So there's something called Kinchin's constant. And so this is just mind-boggling. Take any number that's in the range 0, 1, any real number. And from this, form the continued fraction representation of the number. So this is 1 over A1 plus 1 over A2 plus 1 over A3 plus 1 over A4. And so we have the sequence of numbers, A1, A2, A3, A4, which are the, what I don't know what you call them. And then you form the number k, which is defined to be the product from n equals 1 to infinity of an. Well, so do this, an to the power n, and then take the 1 over nth power. So it's the geometric ratio of all these guys.
The ans are the x's?
No, no. X is a number between 0 and 1.
Okay.
And now you form the continued fraction representation. Suppose x is 0.6.
Oh, okay.
Then a1 will be like, I don't know what it is. It's like 3 and then, you know, so on down the road. Anyway, so the point is that you form these, I don't know what you call these things, these numbers. You form this thing, and then you look at the limit as n goes to infinity. And as n goes to infinity, this goes for almost, but not every, but almost every real number in the range 0, 1. It goes to the number 2.6854... for every single number in this range. It's just science fiction. Like, how is it that every single number has this universality associated with it? Where this fails, rational numbers, it fails. Quadratic irrational numbers, it also fails. And a few other numbers that are still not fully categorized. But every other, you know, irrational number satisfies this bizarre, I don't know. It's just so bizarre. I don't know what, I don't even know what to think about it. Yes?
Kinchin's number is, the A is converged to Kinchin's number. It has its property about itself.
Oh, so if you do, if you apply, do this continued fraction representation, Kinchin's constant.
Yeah. Well, it's not known, but experimentally, it seems to be true.
Okay. So this is something that, to my mind, fits under the category of like math fiction, but it's actually real. There's joins of things like that that are just mind-boggling. Okay. Anyways, so what I want to do today, I have two goals today. First of all, I want to talk about discrete reactions. And I'm going to focus only on the simplest discrete reaction. And I'm going to show you how to solve it from soup to nuts. And I hope I give you a sense of the richness that occurs just in these very simple processes. So I'm talking about single particle birth. And so this is the process where a particle of type A asexually reproduces. So everybody gives birth to children at the same rate, which is some number that I can fix to be 1. And I just want to ask, how does a population evolve? So in the rate equation for this process would be just A dot. If now I denote A as the density of A's, how does it grow? It just grows at a rate proportional to A. And so the solution is A of t is equal to A of 0 e to the t. And so that seems very natural. You just have exponential growth of a population. But now, instead of looking at just the average density, you want to look at the probability of having a fixed number of particles in the system. So again, Pn will be defined to be the probability that there are n particles at time t. And so let me put here Pn of t. And I want to now solve for this full probability distribution. And the reason I want to do this, again, is that it's going to illustrate many of the techniques that I've presented to you over the past week and a half. And hopefully, now that you see it, like for the nth time, it's going to look familiar, and you're going to sort of nod your heads, oh, yes, it makes sense. Everything's following nicely. So let's first of all write down the master equation that describes the evolution of Pn of t. How does this change as a function of time? And I wrote this down at the end of last lecture, but let me do it again. So if I have n particles in the system, the way that I can reach a state with n particles in the system at time t is I started with n minus 1 particles, and somebody gave birth. So, and the point is that the rate at which birth is going to happen is proportional to the number of particles in the system, because everybody's giving birth at the same rate. So this is the rate at which n minus 1 particles give birth times the probability that you have n minus 1 particles. And then this will contribute to the gain of the number of, to the probability that there are n particles in the system. And similarly, if you have n particles in the system, everybody gives birth with the rate 1, and so the population gives birth with the rate n. And so this is the rate at which you lose probability of having n particles in the system because you create n plus 1 particles. So this is the differential equation that I'd like to solve. And as I mentioned last time, without the n's out in front, this is just the Poisson process. But with the n's, it's a little bit more interesting. And so how do we solve this equation? And the trick is that whenever you have, again, these sorts of recursion formulas, this in some sense is a partial difference differential equation. Because here you have time derivative. Here you have differences with respect to n. And you can think in the continuum limit that that is a partial differential. You know, that's like a derivative with respect to n and derivative with respect to time. So it's like a partial differential equation. Anyways, the trick here is that if one multiplies by z to the power n and sums from 1 to infinity and defines a generating function, so let's now define p of z will be defined as a summation from 1 to infinity pn of t z to the power n. And what we're going to see is that by using this, we can transform this recursion formula into a simple differential equation, the wave equation, that we can then solve and get everything out from the system. So let's do that. So first of all, on the left-hand side, we just have d by dt of pn z to the n. And so it's nothing more. And let me be pedantic here for a moment. This p of z actually depends on time as well. So it's p of z and t, because there's a time dependence inside of here. So when I take pn dot z to the n, that's nothing more than just the derivative of this guy with respect to t. So on the left-hand side, I just get dp by dt. And now let's look at the right-hand side. And so let me just do a little worksheet over here. So let's first of all look at summation n equals 1 to infinity n pn z to the power n. What is this? And again, the tricks that I'm going to show you here, they're all very straightforward. And once you get used to them, they become natural. But maybe the first time you see them, they're a little bit unnatural. But the thing is that we want to relate this to the generating function itself. And you see that there's an n sitting out in front, but we have the z to the n. And so if I differentiate with respect to z, there's a natural way of bringing down the factor n, making this a little bit simpler. So let's write this in the following way. I'll write it as d by dz summation dn z to the power n. And you see that when I differentiate with respect to z, down comes a factor n, which is what I want. But then I'm stuck with a z to the n minus 1 here. I'm missing a power of z, so I just restore it. And then everything is nice. So the second term here is just minus z dp by dz. The first term is a little bit more tricky, but you know, it's just, it takes a little bit of simple manipulation to deal with. So here we have the summation n equals 1 to infinity n minus 1 pn minus 1 z to the power n. And here there's a mismatch of the indices here, and so it doesn't look quite so nice. But let's just do some simple things to make it look nice. So what I'm going to do here is let me write this as take a z out in front. And then I'm left with summation n equals 1 to infinity n minus 1 pn minus 1 z to the n minus 1. But now I can shift my indices, because I can say let me call m is equal to n minus 1. And then this becomes a summation z summation over all m. When n is equal to 1, m is equal to 0. So it's m equals 0 to infinity. And I have m pm z to the power m. But notice that when m is equal to 0, the first term is 0. So I can forget about the n equals 0 term and just replace the 0 with the 1. And then this is what we just were dealing with up here. And so this is nothing more than z times z d by dz of p of zt. So the first term then is nothing more than z squared dp by dz. So we transform this difference equation into a partial differential equation. And then, as you're going to see, it's actually a very simple partial differential equation that you actually do know how to solve by elementary techniques from your undergraduate class. So we have dp by dt is equal to z, z minus 1, dp by dz. Now what I'm going to do to make this as simple as possible is that I'm going to now define a new variable, dy, which is equal to dz divided by z, z minus 1. And then you see that what I have on the right-hand side is nothing more than dp by dy, which is nothing more than the good old wave equation that you've learned maybe even in freshman physics. And the solution to this wave equation is p is just some function of y plus t, where the function f you determine from the initial conditions. And once you know it, then you know how to propagate it forward in time, because it says here that p is any function of y plus t, and the function that it could be anything, you fix it by matching it to the initial condition. So that's all there is to it. So at t equals 0, p of z at t equals 0 is just equal to f of y. So, but now the other thing is that from the definition, the generating function, remember that p of z and t was equal to summation pn z to the power n. And now at t equals 0, we have to say have pn at t equals 0 times z to the power n. Let's take as the simplest and most natural initial condition, we start with a population just with one particle. So we start with Adam, and we ask, like, how does humanity evolve? So let's take pn of t equals 0 is just delta of n1. So in this case, the generating function is just z. So over here, we have z. We're almost done now, because what we need to do to figure out what's going on here is that we have to express y as a function of z and vice versa and invert this all this relation. So let's now do a little bit of simple algebra to find y as a function of z. And here, let me note that I can write this in the following way. I do a partial fraction decomposition. And if I do that, this is equal to, I have to fiddle for a minute. So let's put a z minus 1 here, minus 1 over z. No, I guess I want to do it the other way around. Z minus z. No, I want to do it. Which way do I want to do it? Z minus 1 here, z. Yeah, this is the right way. Dz. So I'm just doing a partial fraction decomposition. And this, then, is nothing more than d of logarithm of z minus 1 minus d of logarithm of z, which is the same as d logarithm of z minus 1 over z. So this is what dy is. Therefore, y is equal to log of 1 minus 1 over z. OK. So the thing is that now I go back and figure out what the initial condition is. The thing is that p in this re-expression in terms of y is a function of y. And so what we need to do then to figure out what f of y is, we have to express z now as a function of y. So if I go back here, I have e to the y is equal to 1 minus 1 over z. And so then I get 1 over z is equal to 1 minus e to the y. And so z is equal to 1. Did I get a sign? Is my sign correct? I somehow remember a different sign. Oh, no, the sign is correct. So anyways, we're just about done now, because here's z, which is 1 over 1 minus e to the y. OK. Everybody happy so far? All right. So here was the initial generating function, 1 minus e to the y. But the generating function at any later time is the same function of y, but wherever you see y, replace it by y plus t. So my solution now, pyt is equal to 1 divided by 1 minus e to the y plus t. So that's the answer. And so all I have to do now to extract Pn of t is I've got to re-express this as a function of z, and then expand it into power series and n. And it turns out that because this function has a fairly simple form, these steps are actually quite easy to do. So first thing to make, I erased it. Oh, no, it's right here. So let me now define tau is equal to e to the t. It's just going to make all the formulas a lot simpler. And so I have now pyt is equal to 1 divided by 1 minus tau. And then I have e to the y. But from here, again, we want to express this. Let me now go back to z, because I want to express this in terms of my original variable z. And then when I expand in a power series, I'm going to have my answer. So I've got to express e to the y as a function of z. So let me just put a little fiddle around here. So I have 1 over z is equal to 1 minus e to the y. And so e to the y is equal to 1 minus 1 over z. And I'll write this as z minus 1 over z. So this guy is equal to tau. And e to the y is times z minus 1 over z. So the reason and now in this form, what I want to try and do is make it into a simpler form that I can obviously, that the expansion in a power series in z is obvious. And so notice the following little game. Let me multiply through top and bottom by z. So I have z divided by z minus tau z plus tau. And let me just do a little bit more fiddling. Z over tau. So I'm going to divide top and bottom by tau. And so I'm going to get here 1 minus z tau z minus tau. OK, so so I have sorry, this is the part that I always have such difficulty with. I don't know why. So let's write this as z, 1 minus 1 over tau. Is that right? OK, good. So let's write this as z over tau, 1 minus z, tau minus 1 over tau. Oh, no, I guess I'm not doing anything here. OK, anyways, we're done. The power series representation of this is trivial, because I have z over tau upstairs, 1 minus z over 1 minus z times something downstairs. This is trivial to expand in a power series. And so from this, I infer right away that Pn of t is equal to 1 over tau times 1 minus 1 over tau to the power n minus 1. So there is my answer. So I hope that all these steps are, you don't feel very blown out by them compared to maybe the first time you saw the generating function technique. Let's go a little bit further with this. So here, tau was e to the t. So this is e to the minus t, 1 minus e to the minus t to the power n minus 1. And in the limit of long time, this e to the minus t becomes very small. And this goes approximately into e to the minus t, e to the minus n e to the minus t. So that's another way of writing this in the long time limit. So this is appropriate for t going to infinity. So here's the answer. But now let's look at some of the basic physical properties that come from this problem. Because there's just a host of things which are really quite amazing. So the first point is, now let's plot Pn of t. So we fix our time and plot Pn as a function of n. So this is defined only on the discrete integers. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, dot, 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 dot. So p1 is just e to the minus t. This factor, by construction, is always less than 1. And so P2 is less than P1. P3 is less than P2. In fact, Pn is decaying exponentially in n. The decay constant is determined by this factor. So as t goes to infinity, the decay is extremely slow. And at short times, the decay is fairly rapidly. So if I plot this at early time, I have something that looks maybe something like this. 5, 6. So this might be at early time. And at later time, and so now I'm not going to draw discrete points because it's easier just to draw a curve. So this is for early time. And at later time, it looks something like that. And at still later time, it looks something like that. So the main point is that the most likely event is there's just one particle in the system. So in the initial rate equation approach, we saw that the average density decayed exponentially. The average density grew exponentially with time. And yet the most likely event here is one particle in the system. Yes?
I assume this is caused by our initial condition that the capacitor is at 1. If we had started somewhere in the middle, how would the
left side? What do you mean by middle? You'd start with just a finite number of particles.
No, so would the delta function like n equals 4, I guess.
Nothing changes.
Like, how would the left side work? I mean, like,
well, the thing is that we can, there's a way of thinking about the problem from a scaling perspective. Suppose you say that you start with 4 particles in the system initially. So as time gets very long, the average number of particles is still growing exponentially with time. And so whether I started at 4 or 2 or 1, that number, since it's finite, goes to 0. The ratio of the average number to the initial number goes to infinity. And then you can say any finite initial condition is the same as starting at 1. So morally, you'll get the same behavior with just some little details about like what's going on at the left side of the scale.
I'm wondering, what does the left side look like?
Well, the thing is that there's no way of getting smaller number of particles. So if you start at 4, then this will start, the most likely event will be there are 4 particles in the system. And then there'll be some decay that does, again, the same kind of story with some slight change in details. And in fact, it's an exercise that's fun to do, is just work out the same thing. But instead of having the initial condition being one particle in the system, say delta z4. I mean, you put delta n4, and then this would be z to the power 4. And then you'd have to do the same rigmarole, but everything would work out. Yes?
What's the average number of particles?
OK, very good. Let's do the average number of particles. So the thing is that now we can calculate the average number of particles. Let's do that. So we're going to do n average, which is equal to summation from n equals 1 to infinity. And so we want to do n e to the minus t, 1 minus e to the minus t, to the power n minus 1. And so this is just a geometrical sum with an n. And so hopefully you all know how to do a geometrical sum with an n. You differentiate with respect to a fake parameter. You call this thing here. So let's do the following here. So I'll call this summation from n equals 1 to infinity, n e to the minus t, q to the power n minus 1, which is nothing more than d by dq of e to the minus t times q to the power n from n equals 1 to infinity. And let me do one or two more steps along the way. Because this is point one, that pn of t was peaked at the origin. This is point two, what is n average? And so n, just continuing a little bit more here. So we're going to get e to the minus t, and then I have d by dq. And then I have the summation, which is just q, 1 minus q. And then, yeah? No, but you see, here I'm just inventing a fake parameter. It is true that q is 1 minus e to the minus t. But for the purposes of just pulling out this factor of n, I'm going to say, let me introduce this fake parameter q. And this is just some number that comes out, because I just want to ensure that when I take d by dq, I bring down a factor n. And then I have q to the n minus 1. And after that point, then I set q equals 1 minus e to the minus t. So this is a very handy device for doing these sorts of geometric sums. Anyways, the answer to this is e to the t. I'm not going to fill in these last two steps. I'll leave that for you guys to do. So in fact, we find by this exact discrete approach that the average number of particles agrees with what happened from the rate equation, which is kind of a good sign that we're going to get the right answer. Point number three, which is more mind-boggling, is if I look at sigma squared, which is nothing more than n squared average minus n average squared. So I've shown you, in principle, how you compute n average. And by the same technique, you can compute n squared average. And now you'll just have to do two derivatives with respect to q. And you know, again, it's an entirely straightforward calculation, so I don't want to bore you with those sorts of details. And the point is that this thing is proportional to e to the power 2t. And what that says is that if I then look at the variance, so I look at the square root of sigma squared, so this is equal to the square root of n squared average minus n average squared. So this thing is a measure of the fluctuations in the density. And this is of the order of n average. And so what that means is that in any particular realization of this birth process, you might start with one particle. And in one realization, if you were to simulate it, you go up, say, to a time 1,000. And you get an average number of particles, which is e to the 1,000, which is a huge number. But in another realization, you get an e to the 1,015, which is like, you know, many orders of magnitude bigger than e to the 1,000. So because the fluctuations are of the order of the size of the system, fluctuations from realization to realization are huge. And this feature of non-self-averaging happens a lot in these sorts of processes. And it's a very important thing to keep track of, which is that in statistical physics, you learn this dogma that in the limit of large n, that systems go to their average behavior and fluctuations about the average are small. But this reaction, which is about as simple can be, you see that it doesn't work that way. Fluctuations about the average are not small. And so this is a warning sign that one has to be careful sometimes in these non-equilibrium processes, because you generate large fluctuations with a very simple and natural process. So any questions with this particular story? So let me close this whole story of chemical reactions by talking briefly about the birth-death process, which is, again, as fundamental a model of population biology as you possibly can imagine. So in birth-death, we imagine that we have people who propagate asexually, like that. But we also have, and now let's be general, because we're going to have two different processes. So let me put here rate lambda for the birth rate. But people also die. Everybody dies at some rate. So A goes to 0 with some rate mu. So one can write down an equation for the density of A. A dot is equal to lambda A minus mu A. So this is pretty trivial equations, lambda minus mu A. So it's just the same as before. And we see that in the case where there's birth and death, if the birth rate wins out, the population explodes or grows exponentially. If death wins out, then the population decays away exponentially. And if birth and death are exactly balanced, it looks like we have a steady state, that the density would just stay constant. So let's see what happens if, instead of looking at the level of just assuming no fluctuations, we actually look at the underlying master equation for Pn. And so Pn dot, or dpn by dt, let's write down this master equation. Hopefully now it's pretty obvious what to do. There's the same terms we had before from the pure birth process. So there's a term lambda, because now we're assuming a birth rate lambda times n minus 1, Pn minus 1, minus lambda Pn. That's the contribution due to birth. I can go from n minus 1 to n, and I go from n to n plus 1 at the rate lambda. And there's an n here, thank you. And then there's another term, because I can die, and so with the rate mu, we start with n plus 1 particles in the system, and somebody died, and then we go to n. And so with the probability Pn plus 1 times the total rate, we increase. And then there's minus mu n Pn. So this is a very nice looking equation, lambda n minus 1 Pn minus 1 minus lambda plus mu n Pn plus mu n plus 1 Pn. Whoops, this is a minus 1. Sorry, I was too cavalier here. This, oh no, everything's fine. minus mu n plus 1 p n plus 1. There we go. So let's just sort of stare at this equation for a moment to get a feeling for it. First of all, if there was no n's anywhere, then this looks just like a random walk, because you're having the probability of being at site n, and you can hop from the left to the right, or you can hop from the right to the left, or you hop from site n to either the left or the right. So this is just nothing more than a random walk-like process. With the property, with the powers of n sitting in these terms, something a little different happens, because now we have a random walk in which the rate of hopping is position dependent. So we can think of this as a random walk on the half line n bigger than 0. And the further away I move from the origin, the more particles, the faster there's death, the faster there's birth. And so I have a position-dependent random walk process. And so that's a very simple representation of what's going on. Now, the thing is that by exactly line by line, everything that I did in the past 15 minutes, we can do line by line over here. I can solve this problem by taking the generating function, turning this into a partial differential equation, and then by doing an appropriate variable transformation, we can turn it into just the good old linear wave equation and get the same solution. Everything is line by line, so I'm not going to repeat the same steps for this process. And let me just tell you what the main results that come out of the solution to this master equation. So here are the main results. And again, everything line by line, and if you want me to do it line by line, I'm happy to do it outside of this setting. Anyways, first of all, n average. What does that do? N average is equal to e to the lambda minus mu t. So that's the answer. So when lambda is bigger than mu, we have exponential growth. When lambda is equal to mu, the system is static, whatever that means. We're going to see a little bit more what that means in a moment. And when lambda is less than mu, then the population decays away exponentially in time. Moreover, if I solve for Pn, well, in fact, I'm not even sure if I wrote it down. Did I write it down? I didn't even write it down. I don't know what Pn is. I mean, it's in the notes. But let's look at P0. Because P0 is actually the most interesting feature of this. This is the extinction probability. What is the probability that if we start with one or some number of particles in the system, that the population goes extinct? From the perspective of modern ecology, you worry about things like this, that, you know, there's no more bats anymore, there's no more frogs, everybody's, you know, bees are collapsing. So what is the probability that the population of the simple birth-death process collapses? And it turns out the answer is really simple, but really striking. So the point is that there's two answers, depending on whether lambda is bigger than mu, birth is winning out over death, or lambda is less than or equal to mu. So if death and birth are balanced, or if death wins out, the extinction probability is 1. You're sure that the system is going to die. So it's not so surprising the system is going to die if lambda is less than mu, because death is winning out. But what's also a little bit disturbing, perhaps, at first sight, is that when birth and death are equal, then you're also sure to die. And in fact, this is nothing more than a manifestation of the recurrence of random walks. We learned in the second lecture that I gave that one-dimensional random walks, even though there's no net bias, you're sure to return to the origin. You just have to wait infinitely long to do so. Similarly here, we have a random walk-like process, except for the fact that these hopping rates are position-dependent, but nevertheless, it's symmetrical. And that's enough to show that even in the case of no bias, we end up with extinction. Whereas here, the extinction rate is mu over lambda. This is perhaps the more disturbing element to the problem, because it's showing that if birth wins out over death, there's still a finite chance that everybody's going to die. So it's a little disturbing. You need to, and so you want to make this small, perhaps. Another feature about this is that if I look at sigma squared, the mean square fluctuation, and so this is something like, I think it's like lambda minus mu over lambda plus mu e to the lambda minus mu t times e to the lambda minus mu t minus 1. That's what it is. And notice that here we have the growth rate and the growth rate again. So when this is lambda is bigger than mu, then basically the sigma squared is like n squared. And so if lambda is larger than mu, we get, again, huge fluctuations. So this is, again, worth emphasizing. This process is, in some senses, as well-behaved as a process as you can invent. And nevertheless, one gets huge fluctuations in the system. One last point that I want to mention, which is, so this is maybe result 1, result 2, result 3. By the way, so when lambda is bigger than mu, so this is 3a. When 3b, when lambda is less than mu, then the fluctuations eventually decay with time. As this population gets very small, then the fluctuations disappear. So fluctuations decay. There's an early time transient where the fluctuations grow, but eventually you reach a point where the fluctuations decay away. The other thing is 3c. In this case, sigma squared is something like, I think it's like 2t. I forget, I don't have my notes handy, but I think it's 2t or there's some coefficient. Let me just write proportional to t. It's probably better. So what it's saying here is that in the case where the system is static, where so this is lambda equals, here, let me erase and write it again. Lambda equals mu. In the case where birth and death are balanced, sigma squared is proportional to t. And so this is the proper characterization of what do I mean by a steady system. Namely here, the average population doesn't grow, but nevertheless, the fluctuations are growing. And so what it means is that because we are guaranteed to die if there is balance of between birth and death, of the population, of the realizations of the population that do survive, they've got to spread out very far away from the origin in order that you have, they have to spread very far away from the origin in order for those small realizations to survive. So the thing is that this simple birth-death process has this whole range of possibilities depending on the competition between the birth and the death. So, the main message from these discrete reactions is just how the very simplest kinds of processes are amenable to nice generating function solutions, and that the results that come from them are extremely rich and have many different limiting cases, and also have the sobering feature that when you have a reaction which has a macroscopic bias in one direction, such as here, where birth wins out over death, there's still a chance that death wins. And so it's important to appreciate that fluctuations can play an important role. And this is important in many sorts of ecological applications. So are there any questions with this story? Because now I'm going to do a major shift, because we're going to go to our last topic, networks. OK, so I guess I'm going to ask the maestro to do his thing, because I'm now going to some of this presentation is going to be on my laptop, and so I want to go to it now. So let's see what happens. Excellent. OK. So, this would be easier if I plug in my wireless mouse. So let's do that. Let's see if it works. Excellent. OK. So I want to now go to the last chapter of my course, which is studying complex networks. And I think unless you have been hiding under a rock for the past 10 years, you may know that this process of complex networks, or this game of complex networks, has become white hot over in the recent past. And so I want to give you a flavor of some of the most amazing features of these complex networks. And part of the reason this field has become hot is because in the recent decade, with the advent of the World Wide Web and the advent of having data of anything available online, one sees that the world around us is just basically a big, huge network. The World Wide Web is a network. The internet is a network. Facebook is a network. citations are a network, and the statistical properties of these networks are extremely rich and also can be understood in a very simple fashion. So let me begin by some classic results. I want to talk about the Erdős-Reni random graph as a starting point. And so here, let me leave the slideshow to just show you what the Erdős-Reni random graph looks like. Let me turn on my doodle here. So my battery's kind of kaput. So is there a stick? So here is an example of an Erdős-Reni random graph. This was introduced by Erdős and Reni in 1959, and it's the simplest kind of network model. And it's one of these things that these guys, again, were 50 years ahead of their time. Anybody know the story of Paul Erdős? Anybody know who he is? Some people do, some people don't. He was a Hungarian mathematician who, in the last maybe 40 or 50 years of his life, lived out of a suitcase. And what he would do is he'd just travel around the world, meeting with collaborators, and saying, can I hang out with you for a couple of months and live at your house? And he lived on speed and amphetamines, and he would stay up all night, and he'd stay for 3 months until he wore out his welcome. Whoever he stayed with, they'd prove a couple of theorems, and he'd be famous, and then he'd go on to somebody else. And he did that until around age 83. And so people are always like saying, what is your Erdős number? Again, a network measure of popularity in some sense. Because if you're Erdős, you have Erdős number 0. If you wrote a paper with Erdős, you have Erdős number 1. If you have wrote a paper with someone who wrote a paper with Erdős, you have Erdős number 2. And so it's a measure like how central you are, what is your Erdős number? Or like another example of that is a Clinton number. If you shake hands with Clinton, you have Clinton number 1. And if you shook hands with someone who shook hands with Bill Clinton, you have Clinton number 2. And so the thing is that these numbers very quickly get small, because you might ask, like, what is your Clinton number? And some of you, I know what your Clinton number is. Your Clinton number is 3.
Really?
Yes. Because you've shaken hands with me, and my Clinton number is 2.
But what if your Clinton number is
there you go. What?
What if his Clinton number is lower? You could have shaken hands with Bill Clinton.
No, so, yeah, I mean, but I'm assuming that some guy from Montreal has a chance of his Clinton number being... okay, so what happened here? I need this back again. You have Clinton number 2? Okay. 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 Anyways, but now coming back to the Erdős-Reni random graph. So here is the Erdős-Reni random graph model. You just have a collection of points, and you just join up randomly any pair of points. And so here you see a static graph, which is a realization of the Erdős-Reni random graph. So it kind of looks boring from this perspective. But what I'm going to show you now, that if you look at it from a dynamical perspective, because I'm a dynamical guy, because I do non-equilibrium stat mech, one can understand a lot about the properties of this network in a very natural and a very simple way. So these guys, Erdős and Reni, very smart mathematicians, they proved some amazing theorems about the properties of this network. In particular, as you increase the density of links, this network undergoes a percolation transition from having finite-sized clusters to a cluster whose that is macroscopic. And I'm going to show you how to derive this in basically with pictures only. And just it's a much nicer way of representing the problem. So let's now go to the tape. And so here is my initial starting point of the Erdős-Reni random graph. I start with n isolated nodes. And in principle, every pair of nodes can join with each other. So the number of potential links is the number of pairs, which is going to be n times n minus 1 over 2. And the limit of large n, I'm just going to call that n squared over 2. And now to give this a dynamical perspective, what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce links at a constant rate. And so here's an animation of just introducing links at some constant rate. And this idea was first introduced by these two guys, Elie Ben-Neim and Paul Tarpisky. And so at the end of the day, you build up the static network. But the thing is, by introducing links at a constant rate as you're building up the network, then you can follow what's happening as a function of time. And as you'll see, by looking as a function of time, one can understand the snapshot in any particular time in a very simple way. Now, what rate do I want to introduce my nodes or introduce my links? Here I have all kinds of freedom, and I am going to choose the rate of introducing a new link. I'll introduce links at a rate n over 2. And the reason I'm doing that is the following. It makes things very simple. So let's look at the number of links that have been introduced at time t. So I introduced them at a rate n over 2. And so at time t, the number of links is the rate at which I introduce them times the time, so that's just nt over 2. Now, a natural characteristic of random graphs in general is something called the node degree. And so the node degree is just defined as a number of links that attach to a node. So we're familiar with lattice networks where the node degree is kind of boring. It's sometimes called the coordination number, and it's the same for every single node of the network. But in a random graph, here we have a node of degree 1, here's a node of degree 2, here's a node of degree 3. The node degree is no longer the same for every node, and we can ask in the framework of statistical mechanics, what is the distribution of node degrees? This is the interesting feature of these sorts of random graphs. So before we talk about the distribution of degrees, let's just look at the average degree. Now, the thing is that every single link is attached to two nodes, because there's one end of the link and there's another end of the link. So if I ask, what is the average degree? The average degree is just the number of links that are attached to a node divided by, so it's just the average number of links attached to a node. And the way that I can compute the average degree is I count the total number of links, multiply by 2 to give me the total number of link endpoints. So that's the number of stubs that come into any single node. And then I divide by the total number of nodes. And you see that by this construction of choosing the rate in this way, the average degree is exactly the time. And so what's happening here is that the average degree of this network is growing by 1 at rate 1. It's a very convenient normalization here. So now that we have a simple process for how the average degree increases with time, let's solve the problem of computing the degree distribution of the Erdős-Reni random graph. So again, this is going to look somewhat familiar, I hope. And so here I know I'm being lazy by using the computer. But the thing is that all the formulas you're going to see, you've seen them before written on the blackboard. And so I hope that things will look very familiar. So first of all, I'll define n sub k as the number of nodes of degree k. So this is what might be called the distribution of degrees. But in addition to the number of nodes of degree k, sometimes it's more useful to look at the fraction of the total nodes of degree k. So depending on your taste, either one is fine. And now, what do I do? I do master equations for a living. I mean, everything I see, it's like I have a hammer, and the hammer is the master equation. Everything looks as a nail that I'm going to hit. And so let's now look at the master equation for the fraction of nodes of degree k. How can the number of nodes of degree k change, or the fraction change? So we saw that the average degree was increasing with a rate 1. So if I have a node of degree k minus 1 with a rate 1, we can add a link to it, and it becomes a node of degree k. So the rate at which nk changes is just proportional to the number of nodes of degree k minus 1. And here, with the computer, I have the benefit of using a color coding. So black are gain terms, red are the loss terms. And similarly, if I attach a link to a node of degree k, I create a node of degree k plus 1, and thereby I lose a number of nodes of degree k. Now, if you remember the very first equation I wrote in today's lecture for the birth process, I said if you left out the prefactors n, you would get this equation, which is nothing more than the equation of the Poisson process. And maybe some of you have seen this in your undergraduate careers, maybe you haven't, but nevertheless, it's the Poisson process. And the solution is the Poisson distribution. And so I invite you, if you don't know how to solve this equation, try and solve it, maybe in a tutorial or on your own. You can solve it either by the generating function technique. But this equation is sufficiently simple that you can just solve it one by one. And in fact, in undergraduate courses, like in the standard mathematical physics book for undergraduates, like Arfkin or something like that, he has this example. And you can solve it by the Laplace transform method. And typically, whenever you can solve a problem, you can solve it like 10 different ways. And so it's fun to take a problem that you know how to solve and solve it in other ways and just see like how to compare the different types of solutions. But the main point of this is that this Poisson degree distribution has a large, it decays very rapidly for large k. It decays even faster than exponential because of this factor k factorial that's in the denominator. So what it's telling us is that even though the graph is random in some sense, the degrees are relatively sharply distributed about their mean value. The mean degree is t. And the fluctuations about the mean degree are of the order square root of t. And that's the basic features of the Poisson process. Okay, so that's one fact about the Erdős-Reni random graph that I hope is seems familiar to you. The second part, which is what was the original advance of the work of Erdős and Reni themselves, was to find the percolation transition. And this is a spectacular feature that was discovered. Erdős and Reni is in 59, and for lattice networks, percolation was discovered in the middle 50s by Broadbent and Hammersley. And again, the thing about the percolation transition is that it's as simple a process as you could possibly imagine. You just have a bunch of points, you link them together, and when the density of links is small, the clusters that are formed are isolated and small, and as you increase the density of links, but far away from having every link connected, you get a transition where everything connects into a single macroscopic cluster. And so in the case here for the Erdős-Reni random graph, as you're going to see, you already know what the percolation transition is. Yes?
For these links, though, does a node have to link to a node that's next to it, or can it link to a node that's...
Well, in the Erdős-Reni random graph, there's no geometry, so any node with equal probability will link to any other node in the network. So this is yeah, there's no notion of distance here. There's just a collection of nodes, and you're just linking randomly between any pair of nodes.
So what do you mean by the clusters being isolated?
Well, for example, here in this particular picture, we have some nodes, these two, this one, single site nodes. They are nodes of size one. And here we have a little dimer. So we have clusters of size one. We have a cluster, two clusters of size two, and one cluster of size six, or two clusters of size six, which are the biggest clusters in the system. If I put in a few more links in the system, we will find that all the nodes will be joined together, and there'll only be one cluster of size, the total number of nodes in the system, and no other clusters of any smaller size. And in fact, that's a very strange feature about the Erdős-Reni random graph, is that there is, in addition to the percolation transition where a macroscopic cluster first emerges, there is a second transition where the system in some sense becomes complete. There's no finite clusters of any size left. So it's geometrically an extremely rich process. But let me just first talk about the percolation transition. And I told you, you already know it, because I've actually described this process in the framework of aggregation kinetics. And that's another feature that I want to try and emphasize in this in the last lecture, which is that there's so much unity in techniques and ideas between different fields of StatMech that seem completely disconnected. Last week, I spent a lot of time discussing aggregation kinetics. Here I'm talking about the geometry of a random cluster. And it turns out that the methods and the solutions of these two processes are essentially identical. So let's see how that comes about. Let's analyze now for the percolation transition. So the point here is that we have some network at some intermediate stage of the growth process, and we're adding links one by one at some rate, and we want to ask, how does the cluster size distribution evolve? So let's see how it evolves. So first point is that when you add another link, all that can happen is clusters can merge. You can't create new clusters out of nothing, because you start with n clusters of size one, and by adding links, clusters are only merging and getting larger in size. And so let's focus attention on the purple cluster and the green cluster and ask, what is the rate at which these two clusters will be joined? So the point is that if this cluster, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so it has a cluster of size 6 points, or let's now use the word mass. Let's imagine that each point has a mass 1 and the links have no mass. So we have a cluster of mass 6. And we have another cluster. In this particular case, it's mass 6 as well. But we could, in general, this is mass I and mass j. We ask, what is the rate at which these two clusters will join? And the point is that because any node here can join to any node over here, the joining rate is clearly proportional to the square of their masses. The merging rate is proportional to the mass of one times the mass of the other. So here's a typical link which joins them, but this endpoint could be anyone in j places. This endpoint could be anywhere in I places. And so the merging rate is proportional to ij. And so this is nothing more than good old product kernel aggregation from last week. And then we can now write down the master equations for the cluster concentration ck. So now let me denote ck as a concentration of clusters of mass k. And here I don't feel guilty in writing down a complicated equation and flashing it by quickly, because I already spent a lot of time last week writing it down on the blackboard very carefully. But you know, there's the same gain term, because cluster of mass I and mass j can join at rate ICI times JCJ to give rise to a cluster of mass k. And a cluster of mass k can be lost, because a cluster of mass k can join with a cluster of any other mass at the rate KCK ICI. And so that's the loss term. So hopefully, you know, you're not intimidated when you see this equation, because you saw it last week. And anyways, so we know what the solution is. It's just this. And the thing about the solution is that if you look at the asymptotics, and I did some of this last week, for t less than 1, everything is dominated by the exponential decay here. And as t approaches 1, the decay, you know, these other terms start to conspire and give rise to some additional corrections. But the main point is that the cluster mass distribution is decaying exponentially with mass. So what that means is that the average cluster size, if we have a distribution which has an exponential decay, the average size is going to be a finite number. And in fact, I guess I did this last week, is that by using simple ideas from extreme value statistics, we saw that the largest size was of the order of logarithm of the total number of nodes in the network. On the other hand, when t equals 1, this goes away. K factorial I can write as k over e to the k times 1 over square root of 2 pi k. And the k to the k cancels k minus 2 powers of k over here. And you're left with 1 over 2 pi k to the 5 all square root, which is precisely what you have here. So the mass distribution changes from having an exponential character for t less than 1 to a power law at t equals 1. And this power law is such that the mean square cluster size is divergent at the percolation point. So the basic features of what happens in the Erdős Reinl random graph are identical to good old product kernel aggregation. And one can derive all its results very simply. Yes?
And what does t equals 1 correspond to here? This?
So this corresponds exactly to the percolation transition. This is where you get the transition from having isolated finite size clusters to a single cluster that that contains a finite fraction. Well, let me be a little bit more precise. At t equals 1 is what's called the percolation threshold. When t is larger than 1, the fraction of sites or nodes that belong to the largest cluster is a finite fraction of all nodes in the network. You may remember that there was some equation I wrote last week. There was something like g, the gel fraction, that satisfied something like 1 minus e to the minus gt. And so this had the solution that g was equal to 0 for t less than 1. And it was greater than 0, and I forget what it is, for t larger than 1. So there's no gel at early times, and then there is a gel beyond t equals 1. And at t equals 1, there is the transition point. And another way to characterize what's going on is if I look at the largest cluster, let's call k max the size of the largest cluster. This k-max has 3 possible answers depending on what t is. When t is less than 1, this is proportional to logarithm of n, because we have an exponentially decaying mass distribution. And when I look at the largest cluster from an exponential distribution, it's of order log n. When t is larger than 1, then the largest cluster is proportional to n. In fact, it's just g times n. Whereas here, the largest cluster is proportional to n to the power 2/3. So that's what I mean by, at the transition point, it's like a macroscopic cluster, because it's like power law size, but it's actually an infinitesimal fraction of the entire system. OK. So let me just, again, I'm just pulling up formulas from last week that if I look at the second moment of this distribution, it is this. So it diverges at t equals 1. OK. So I want to now turn to more modern applications. And so you see, here's modern, Cayley, 1857. It's quite amazing what some of these old classic guys have done. And so I want to now present to you a very simple type of graph called a random recursive tree. So in the end, what is my goal here? I'm going to try and describe to you the behavior of complex networks with broad degree distributions, the so-called scale-free networks. And let me ask, first of all, how many people have heard the terminology scale-free networks? Half the class. OK. So thing is that scale-free networks, as I mentioned at the very start of this little ditty, is sort of taken over statistical physics in the past 10 years. And because the whole world is somehow networked in all different ways, and one finds that the underlying networks are complex in character, so characterizing these complex networks has been really hot. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to approach this from a very unusual way, because I'm going to first solve a very classic problem from 1857, the random recursive tree. And then I'm going to show you that with a very little simple trick, one can then get all the behaviors of complex networks in a very nice and satisfying and analytic way. And again, the tools that I'm going to use to analyze this type of network is the good old master equation. And I hope by the end of tomorrow's lecture, you'll get a sense that the master equation is actually useful, because it can solve almost anything that you can think of. So let's first of all talk about what is the random recursive tree. So here it is. I'm going to give you a little animation. We start with a single node, and I'm going to build up a network one by adding new nodes into the network. So here comes node number two. I just add, and they're coming pretty quickly. So I'm introducing nodes one at a time. So here, node two came to node one. Node 3 comes in, and he's got two choices. He can either add to node 2 or node 1. And so I'm just going to choose randomly and uniformly that 3 attached to 2. And when 4 comes in, he's got three choices, 1, 2, 3. And in this particular case, he happened to choose node 3. And so here's node 5. I'm adding nodes. I'm attaching always to one earlier node randomly and uniformly. And so I continue this process. Here's node 6, 7, and so on. Yes, Chris.
Have we switched into a directed graph, or are those arrows just to indicate what order the new nodes have attached?
Yeah, the arrows are just here as a crutch, just to sort of keep track of like the order in which things are attaching.
But it's still the non-directed graph.
Yeah, I mean, for the purposes that I'm going to be concerned about, which is the degree distribution, all I care about is the number of bonds that are touching node 4, so whether it's an outgoing arrow or an ingoing arrow, I'm not going to pay attention to it. We could, and this would provide a more detailed characterization, but for our purposes, it's not necessary. Anyways, and as we saw from the Erdős-Reni random graph, the thing that I want to calculate is this degree distribution. And so this is the number of nodes that have k links attached to them. So I hope that you guessed what's going to happen next. I'm going to write down a master equation for the evolution of this degree distribution and solve it. So let's do that. So here's my master equation. And so let me take some time to explain what it involves. The first term kind of looks like the Poisson process that we had before. Remember, there was a gain term which involved nk minus 1 and a loss term which is nk. But here it's slightly different, so let me spend some time explaining what's going on. So first point is that in this process, there's no notion of time, because all that matters is the size of the network. So instead of using time as my variable, I'll use the total number of nodes in the network as my effective time-like variable. So I'm writing how the number of nodes of degree k changes each time I add one new node to the network. Yes?
So why didn't we do that before?
Why didn't we?
Yeah.
Because it was, in the case of the Erdős-Reni random graph, it was convenient to think of a dynamical process that I could make analogy with product kernel aggregation. Yeah. So it really, you have a lot of freedom here, and you might as well just do things as easy as possible. Anyways, so again, this is my time-like variable. And so now let's parse what's happening here. So again, there are three terms in the equation. And let me remind you from back two slides back about the master equation for the degree distribution of the Erdős-Reni random graph or that of the Poisson process. So it looks like this, but there's one more term over here. And so we'll have to explain what are the origin of these different terms. So again, I described the time variable as n. And now, again, we have in black, we have a gain term, because I can create a node of degree k by attaching to a node of degree k minus 1. And then I'll create a node of degree k. What is the rate, or what is the probability that I'm going to attach to a node of degree k minus 1? Well, if I'm attaching to all nodes uniformly and randomly, I have a total of n nodes. And out of those n nodes, there's n k minus 1 that have degree k minus 1. So this ratio is just the probability of attaching to a node of degree k minus 1 in a single addition event. And so if I attach with this probability, this will then increase nk by 1. And similarly, this term, nk over capital N, is just the probability that I'm going to attach to a node of degree k. And if I attach to such a node, I decrease the number of nodes of degree k. And that's why this comes with a minus sign. There's one more term here, the delta function. And the difference here compared to the Erdős-Reni random graph, where the number of nodes was fixed and I was just adding links, in this case, I'm adding links and I'm adding new nodes all the time. So every single time there's a change, I'm always adding one new node of degree 1, because you know, in comes a new node, the front of the arrow attaches to the graph, but the back of the arrow is attached to a node of degree 1. And so that's why there's this delta function term here. OK, so anyways, so again, when you're confronted with master equations of this type, how might you go about solving them? There's lots of different techniques that you might want to do. You might want to apply the generating function, because now you've seen that it works. You might want to try and solve them one by one. And in this particular case, if you just solve them one by one, because they're so simple in form, here's a solution when you just solve them one by one. And again, I'm not going to do this on the blackboard because this is just elementary sophomore level differential equations. But you can just see that what is the equation for n0 dot, the number of nodes degree 0? This term is 0. There's no nodes of degree minus 1. So you just have dn0 by dn is minus n0 over n. And the solution is just n0 is 1 over n. So that initial site, you know, if we start with a single initial node which had degree 0, then the rate at which it decays away, at least in this formulation, is 1 over n. In fact, here's something a little bit funky going on, because you know that in the discrete process, when I added a new node, there's no more nodes of degree 0 ever left. This is appropriate for a continuum description where I'm replacing a discrete difference, the number of nodes at degree k at the nth point minus the number of nodes of degree k at the n minus 1 would be a discrete difference equation. And so the actual solution for the discrete difference equation would not have this behavior. But because I've turned this into a derivative, we have this somewhat bizarre looking thing here. But it's not terribly important, because we're typically interested for large degree. Yes?
So can you explain again why it's 1 over n?
Yeah, the reason why it's 1 over n is that the true discrete process is that I have, at each time I add a new node, n is increasing by 1. So the true discrete process would be I should write an equation for nk at when as a function of n minus nk at n minus 1. I should write a discrete equation for how the number of nodes of degree changes each time I add a new node. What I've done here is I've replaced nk at n minus nk at n minus 1 by the derivative. That change, that replacement of a discrete difference by derivative, is not kosher for a small degree. It works perfectly fine for high degree, but it doesn't work for small degree. And that's why you get this unphysical result for the number of nodes of degree 0. Because this is saying that after, you know, we saw in the process that I start with a single node of degree 0. When the first node came in, there's no more nodes of degree 0. But here it's saying they last forever, but they don't. And so that's continuous versus discrete. Anyways, in a similar fashion, one can solve these equations one by one. And you notice something that looks simple. So first of all, this is 1 over n. We can forget about it in a long time limit. But here we have n over 2, n over 4, n3 is n over 8. They actually look all very simple. And in fact, we can do something to make life even simpler. Because you know, the thing about some of these complex processes is that it pays to be lazy. It pays to try and do as much massaging of the formulation of the problem as possible at the start to make the algebra as simple as possible. And the thing is that when you start solving by one by one, you see that n1, n2, n3, n4 are all proportional to n with a different coefficient. So let's start by assuming that n sub k, capital N sub k, is proportional to n times some density, which is the density of sites of degree k.
How is anything other than our definition of Bacon and Lindley something?
It is. It's nothing else but that.
Okay.
But the point is that by using, I'm starting with a master equation for capital N, and now I'm going to now convert it to an equation for little n. And something magical happens, because here we had a differential equation. But if I have capital NK is proportional to capital N, when I do the derivative, I'm just going to get NK on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side, the N in the denominator cancels the N in the numerator, and I just get this. So I convert a differential equation into just an algebraic equation. So that's the point of doing this. And so this is just a high school recursion formula that you can just plug in, start at 1, and just recurse up, and you get right away 2 to the minus k. So from this solution, we see that the degree distribution, which is considered to be the characteristic of these complex networks, or a basic characteristic, is an exponential degree distribution. So it's not a broad distribution, but a sharp one. But we calculate we can calculate it in complete detail. OK, so I guess, Dennis, should I stop now?
Yeah,
so let me just say one thing about what I'm going to do tomorrow. So what I've shown you now is several things. I've talked about the Erdős-Reni random graph, which was a very simple but rich network that had this notion of just attaching links randomly between nodes. And that was kind of a sidelight to the main theme of what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow, which is the problem of complex networks. And I started by describing the so-called random recursive tree. And if anybody does graph theory, this is like one of the basic constructs in graph theory. And what I'm going to show tomorrow is that by taking a tiny little tweak on this rule, really tiny, we can change this model of a trivial network with a sharp degree distribution into a scale-free network with a broad degree distribution by a very simple tweak. And so that will bring us then to the story of complex networks, which will be the focus of tomorrow's and my last lecture. So I guess that's it for today. So any questions? Lunchtime?